Welcome to Web3 with A16Z, a show about building the next generation of the internet from the team at A16Z Crypto. This episode features Brian Armstrong, CEO and co-founder of Coinbase, in conversation with A16Z Crypto founder and managing partner Chris Dixon. The conversation was originally recorded at our Founder Summit in November. It covers the aftermath of FTX and the rise of crypto in politics. But it also goes into company building at scale, lessons for directing product development, how to balance core business with disruptive innovation, and more. As a reminder, none of the following should be taken as business, legal, tax, or investment advice. Please see a16z.com/disclosures for more important information, including a link to a list of our investments.
So I don't think Brian needs an introduction, but I'll very briefly, the co-founder of Coinbase, we've worked together for now. It's actually 10 years this month that we invested in Coinbase, which was a thank you. That was very good investment for us.
And thank you, yeah. Honestly.
And we have some, we were just reminiscing backstage. It was an exciting So I think we'd first met in, I think it was like February of 2013, mm-hmm. When you were doing your Series A. And then I remember coming by a few times to visit you guys. You had like 8 people in that apartment. Mm-hmm. And then I kind of messed it up. And I think I gave you too low of a valuation offer. And
you guys passed on the Series A, I think.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Series B, we came back to talk. Okay, yeah. You gave us an initial offer.
Yeah, and it was like kind of low. You guys were kind of annoyed.
Well, I wasn't upset. I mean, in any negotiation, you got to make a first offer. Yeah.
And then...
as an entrepreneur, we were just like, oh, shit, we got to get somebody else to bid so we can try to have a bit of a process. But...
And then I remember I was in New York and I was like, oh, I realized I'd messed it up. And then you had other offers and I was like, okay, I'm going to lose this and screw it up. And I remember flying back. Do you remember that time? It was like midnight at your office. Do you remember that when Balaji came?
Yeah. Is this when you,
cause it was like midnight. I flew in and I was like, shit, I like ruined this. Like I messed it up. And then I was, and then you were like, well, I want to make sure you're serious about crypto. And I was like, the way to prove that I'm serious is I'm going to bring Balaji, who we just written a $25 million check to build semiconductors dipped in mineral oil to mine Bitcoin. And like, how much more serious can you be than to write that guy a $25 million check to do that? And so he showed up like in his Balaji style, like in his sweatpants at like midnight. Mm-hmm. You and Fred, you remember this?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
It was great.
And then we had like this 4-hour deep dive of like the future and everything else. And I felt like that was like the moment in which we maybe saved it.
I appreciated that you flew in. It definitely showed a lot of commitment. So,
anyways, it was a fun time.
I think we left and we're like, that guy, Balaji's crazy, but you know, but awesome. And Chris seems cool. So, you know, why not?
Yeah. we love Balaji. Balaji's, you know, for those, you probably all know Balaji, but he was like at the time, like, I mean, he had like the whole like Stanford Bitcoin group and doing all this interesting stuff.
And of course, he later joined Coinbase. We acquired his startup. Yeah. Yeah, lots of good stories.
Anyways, that was fun. So it's been an amazing ride, 10 years. And it's amazing what you did, like to build it up into such a, you know, big and important company and all the work you've done. So with that, maybe we'll jump into some of the stuff going on now. Last year we were here, I think you spoke to Ben and FTX had just blown up. And now obviously SBF has been convicted. What do you think, how do you feel about the sort of state of the industry, what that means? Hopefully we're moving beyond that now. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so I think the conviction for SBF was hopefully a turning point. Psychologically, I think we can all kind of move on. Justice has been served. I mean, we'll get the sentencing. There'll be other cases. There'll probably be movies that come out. So, you know, it's not like it'll be completely gone from the consciousness of the community, but psychologically, I think now we're allowed to turn the page. And this kind of reminds me, actually, I think it was back in 2014 when Mt. Gox blew up.
Yeah.
So that was the thing that reminds me of the most. And I remember at that time it was very similar, and there was all these articles being written about, oh, Bitcoin's over, and Everybody couldn't stop talking about it. It was just like a scar on people's minds. So
Mt. Gox was like the main, wasn't that the biggest exchange at the time or something?
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, something, I remember it took about 1 year and yeah. somehow like a year passed and then people just stopped talking about it and they were ready to move on to new things. And I remember when FTX blew up, I was like, well, this is going to suck, but it'll probably be in a year, people will just mentally move on. Yeah. And that's roughly what's been happening. So I think society needs a sacrificial scapegoat, someone to point to and say, this was the root of it, even if it's, you know, more nuanced than that. And of course, what he did was terrible and it was fraud. So I think we can all move on.
Did you feel like you knew, did you suspect that something was up?
I did not. I wish I could tell you I did. I'd met with him a number of times and he always struck me as somebody who was very intelligent, perhaps a bit young and reckless, but I definitely did not think he was fraudulent. Yeah. So I kind of got duped along with everybody else. It made me a little more skeptical. If I ever see somebody sort of on like a meteoric rise, like with their face on the front of magazines, I'm going to be more skeptical, I think, at this point. But yeah, that was a wild one.
Yeah. And then that sort of the FTX stuff kind of catalyzed a lot of the SEC stuff and just sort of the policy reaction. I think partly, I don't know, it just, I think one was some of the politicians were taking money from SBF and then felt like they needed to make up for it maybe. And it also emboldened the critics.
Mm-hmm.
So what's your take on sort of what happened this last year on the policy side and how have you been addressing it?
Yeah, well, I definitely, another thing that's helped us move on is I think some people were wondering, is he going to get away with it because of all the donations that he made? And so it did kind of feel reassuring that, okay, there is some sense of justice that's beyond, people bribing and this kind of stuff. So that helped a lot too. But I think, certainly the FTX blow up did kind of give a gift to some enemies of crypto, and they each kind of have their own motive for why they don't like crypto. You know, they want the big banks to have power. They're just afraid of change and there's moral panics. Maybe they just are anti-freedom or whatever, and they want to control society instead of allowing people to have freedom. But for whatever reason, they took it as a gift, never let a good crisis go to waste. And so we did see, Gary Gensler, Elizabeth Warren, especially really make a concerted effort to kill crypto and kill the industry. They did it, through Operation Choke Point 2.0. They did it with...
That's the banks. So for those who don't know, that's many of you have not been able to get bank accounts. And that's sort of this back channel thing that we
think. Yep, exactly. And, through the media, through just indiscriminate kind of lawsuits being sent out to everybody. And so, look, the bad news is that they were able to harm the industry over a relatively short period of time, I would say a couple of years. The good news is that they failed to kill crypto. We're still here. We're all going to keep building. The justice system in the U.S., there are, luckily in the U.S., we have these different branches of government. The courts have been really good at upholding rule of law, even when the SEC is kind of painting outside the bounds of the law and sending off these court cases, which, by the way, Gensler's a smart guy. I think intellectually he knows that some of these are pretty weak cases and he's unlikely to win them. He doesn't care. He's just trying to cast a shadow over the industry, show that he was tough on crypto, and then, try to go on to his next thing. I think, look, the courts are upholding rule of law. That's great. And we have to remember that in the U.S., we get the winds blow one way and they blow the other way every 4 to 8 years. And that's a really great thing because, we as an industry and we, all the companies in this room, we can outlast any regulator, any appointed official, any bureaucrat, any administration. And if we were building our companies in China or something like that, we wouldn't have that. You might have the same person in power for 30 years. Yeah. Here, I think, by the way, this is where we all have to kind of show up as an industry in 2024 and send a very clear message during the election period that if there are anti-crypto candidates out there, they've got to go. We can talk about that too.
Yeah, I mean, what should people be doing on the policy side in this room, for example?
Well, the biggest thing, I could use everyone's help with. Both A16Z and Coinbase. By the way, A16Z has been incredible on the policy front. I mean, you guys are all over DC. There's a lot of education, advocacy, money being moved, all kinds of good things. So Coinbase is trying to do our part as well. And every time we see you guys step up, we're like, all right, we got to do more too. So I love what A16Z has been doing. But one thing I think we can ask from everybody in the room here is, there's an industry group, standwithcrypto.org. Go check it out. Go sign up. If you can help us share that message out there on social, maybe in your products, with your employees. You know, the idea behind it is to try to, there's 52 million people in the US who have used crypto. Maybe, can we just get 1 million of them to raise their hand and say, hey, I really care about this as an issue, as a voter. And that would be enough people to really move the needle in a lot of these districts, congressional races, local politics, even in presidential races, potentially. And so we're asking those people who are raising their hands to sort of say, okay, can you, you know, can you donate? Can you vote? Can you call your congressperson? Can you share this on social? Can you show up at this town hall? And really, there's a number of candidates. If you look at different districts, there's like, typically there'll be like a pro-crypto candidate, an anti-crypto candidate. Oftentimes they'll go in there and try to educate the anti-crypto candidate because half the time they're just sort of ignorant of the facts. They're just getting disinformation from somewhere. But, you know, if there's an educational effort and they're not willing to kind of be constructive in around crypto policy and ensuring people have the freedom to use this technology, then, you know, they got to go. Yeah. And this is where we can act. Like in an example, I think Coinbase has roughly 1 million users in Ohio. That's a key state right now with Sherrod Brown. And he's vulnerable. I mean, yeah. He's behind in the polls. He's anti-crypto. These are the kinds of things where we could move the needle on, I don't know, 10, 20 different congressional seats in 2024. So yeah, please sign up on standwithcrypto.org and help us share the word on that. Let's get to 1 million citizens in the US who will raise their hand and say, we care about this issue.
Yeah, I would just add to that, like, so I, like you, I've been going to DC a lot and meeting with elected officials. I would say it makes me kind of more optimistic in some ways. Like one, a lot of them I meet with, I think they're actually trying, you know, they want to understand and they actually want to, they want to do the right thing. Like contrary to the kind of cynical view of politics. I mean, there is a lot of things to be cynical about and the money and everything else. But like one is, and they say to me repeatedly, like, you're one of the first people that's sort of shown up that's like explained this in a coherent way. I think a lot of the industry representation has been either kind of extreme sort of Bitcoin libertarianism or just not very well done, or like SBF, obviously, you know, just sort of negative. So like the bar is kind of low, which is kind of a good thing. Like if you show up and you're reasonable and you're trying to build something that's like societally productive, people seem impressed and they seem to listen. And there aren't that many people showing up, like actually going to DC, actually going to these meetings. Also on the money side, like it doesn't take that much money to, you know, if you're able to donate personally to candidates you like, it doesn't take that much to have an impact there. So anyway, so it makes me kind of more, I think in some ways the industry has done such a bad job. I'm not, you know, like this is like years ago, I'm just sort of ignoring this or taking an extremist view that if we just do some stuff, like this really matters what people do. We had one day we went to DC and we brought a few entrepreneurs, some in the room, and it made a huge difference. Like the elected officials saw them and said, these are like reasonable people building productive things. This is very different than what I've been told of like people trying to take down the government or something. Right.
Right.
And they're like, why are we banning this? Like essentially, like, you know, so I, and we've got, by the way, in the bill that got through committee, the FIT 21 market structure bill, which would basically solve these issues, the security issues. It was a unanimous on the Republican side and in the, you know, six Democrats, which is a big deal. And including important ones who all had switched sides, by the way, like they were not for this a year ago. And so I think there's a lot of reasons to be optimistic long-term. I am.
Yeah. No, I feel very optimistic. The US is going to get this right eventually. So there's a good Winston Churchill quote around that, but yeah.
So maybe let's switch gears a little bit to tech. So you've done a bunch of interesting stuff. Just looking at your last earnings, reading the public stuff, it seems like you have this pretty interesting growing stablecoin business. And then I think what I find really exciting is the stuff you're doing with Base, which is really innovative and I think really pushing kind of the utility side. So you're not just sort of a trading platform, but like a real application platform. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about how you're thinking about that.
Yeah, well, so of course, Coinbase started off as an exchange, and we're now doing many different things. And I've always been really, I'm not really a trader at heart, actually. I'm really got excited about crypto in terms of creating more economic freedom globally and like a more efficient financial system and payments. And if we can just make payments like fast, cheap, global, kind of like a WhatsApp message, that alone would just unlock an incredible amount of potential in the world. And so anyway, we've been very excited about kind of self-custodial wallets, like commerce applications, payments, stable coins for a long time. We have product efforts in each of those areas. One of the biggest areas, I mean, I don't have to tell this crowd this, but layer two is a huge deal, I think. It is one of the best opportunities we have to kind of kick off the next wave of adoption and innovation in crypto. How do we get it to the next 100 million people? How do we get it to 1 billion people using this technology globally? I think layer two is going to play a huge role in that. It's kind of like the internet moving from dial-up to broadband, right? And so it'll, you know, when you bring down cost, you bring down the time to confirm these transactions, like a whole new wave of applications kind of get opened up. So we're trying to do our part in that in with Coinbase, and we've launched Base, this layer two solution built on the Optimism stack. So we're trying to work with the community. It's not just one more layer two. It's using the Optimism stack. And there's lots of good layer twos out there, by the way. We're going to integrate a lot of them. So I'm not trying to pick favorites here, but we happen to build Base on top of that. It's I think it's number three L2 now by TVL and transactions per second, things like that. We're trying to reach out to everybody in the community building these applications and just talk to them about how they can integrate it. One of the things we're tracking internally at Coinbase is what percentage of transactions happening on Coinbase are happening on layer two. Today, it's about 7%. You know, I think that's way too low. I think we're going to be in a world here in 3 or 4 years where the layer two is the default, right? And it's kind of like, I don't know what an example would be like. This is a bad example, but if you're on the internet, you know, and you like, could you manually, you know, use Telnet to connect to some IP address or something? Like, yes, you could, but nobody does that, right? Or, you know, if you're on like a low bandwidth connection or something, maybe it's a better analogy. But long story short is we should be getting 99% of transactions happening on L2. It should be the default for everything. If somebody really wants to do an L1 transaction, it should be possible. But L2 should be the default. We're also tracking internally this metric of, you know, the average time to confirmation and the average cost of a transaction. And right now, I think across all networks, all blockchains on Coinbase, it's about 20 minutes to get final confirmation and something like $3 or something on average if you look at transaction fees. We're trying to get that. I gave the team this kind of crazy goal. It's like, how do we get it under 1 second and 1 cent, you know, as an average across all transactions happening in crypto? And of course, a big piece of that's got to be layer two. Layer two has got to be the default for that to happen. Lightning Network has got to happen. All these different pieces. So, you know, we might even be able to do smart things around optimistic confirmation, you know, and you could imagine end to end, if you instrument that, where is the time taking for a transaction to confirm? So if we get it under 1 second, 1 cent, global payments, you know, you can imagine anywhere in the world, someone with a phone is just like, scan that QR, hit pay. And then like within 1 second, it shows a green check somewhere on the other side or whatever. It's like, we're going to see an explosion, I think, of payments, utility, use cases. You know, trading is something where even on a decentralized exchange or something, you could do one trade and you could wait 20 minutes. It's not a big deal. But if we're going to be building all these applications, decentralized social, like, you know, identity, login, badging into buildings, like DAO, you know, we need everything to be fast and cheap. And so anyway, if anybody is building out there and hasn't looked at Base, I would love it if they did. So let's build it together.
That's great. I think it's great that you're pushing that forward. And I also like the attestation thing you did recently. So this is like, you can, I think, use, you have how many 100 million or something users or some number. And so those 100 million can now, go and attest on Base that they live in a certain country. And I don't know if you have KYC in there yet, or I assume that you don't have to.
On-chain attestation. Yeah. So we're doing lots of stuff on-chain now. I think it's really incumbent on us as a company to do. We're trying to shift more and more. Like, the default is everything we're going to do in the future will be on-chain.
Yeah.
There's a good reason not to. We may not to, but it's sort of like mobile first, or, you know, these big pushes culturally you have to make inside companies. Yeah. Like, on-chain is the new online, so it's on-chain first is kind of the mentality.
That was a really nice feature, because you're taking advantage. Like, people have already gone through all of the driver's license KYC stuff on Coinbase, so why make them do it again? And it's nice. I liked it because it's opt-in, so the user has power. But they can opt into a really easy way to get KYC'd, and then that will in turn, you know, if required, you know, make it more frictionless to use other applications.
And yeah, so it's like really and it's nice. Not just Coinbase too. Any company could provide this kind of attestation on chain, and, you know, I think that's an important piece of the ecosystem developing.
So as I mentioned, it's been 10 years since we invested. You've been doing this, I guess, 11 years now. Is that right, or something like that? And you've seen multiple waves and, you know, sort of downturns in this last one. You know, tell us sort of how is that, like, about your sort of founder journey, and how has that been kind of going through those different waves, and, you know, how do you keep yourself inspired?
Yeah, well, I mean, so everybody, if I don't know if how many people in the room, maybe this is the first crypto winter, but yeah, we've been through a few of them now, and you kind of have to, on the way up, you know, there's so much hype and great articles being written about it, and you're getting invited to cool parties and journalists want to talk to you. And, you know, when things are down, you stop getting invited to cool things. Journalists ask you dumb questions like, you know, what are you going to do now that crypto's over or whatever. They haven't really asked me that in this downturn, which is a shift.
It was like clean tech for me. Like, you're the VC who did clean tech. You know, I was like this bad nigga.
Yeah, yeah. So there's definitely an art to cultivating this mindset of just like tuning out all the noise. Like if people are saying you're great, you got to ignore that. And if they say you suck, you got to ignore that. And that's just a journey of entrepreneurship is like, you know, when FTX blew up or the macro economy came down, I was like, all right, we've seen this before. The next few years are going to kind of suck. But let's just wake up every day, put one foot in front of the other, try to build some good stuff. Like this too will pass. And so there's definitely an art to kind of getting in front of the company. You know, any of you may have, as founders may have felt this, where sometimes you feel like, oh shit, I got to get in front of the company and like put on a good face and like tell them how excited I am, and carry the team. And there's certainly an element of truth to that. Like, you know, entrepreneurship's not fun. It's supposed to be hard. That's what makes it fulfilling and like building something good in the world over many, many decades. So there's some mornings where I wake up and I'm just like, oh man, like, my mind's not in the right place, or like I'm tired or whatever. I've been grinding the last like whatever 3 weeks. And, you know, I try to just like have this morning routine where I get myself psyched up. And, you know, I saw a bunch of you at the gym this morning and like, you know, put on a little David Goggins or, you know, I like listening to biographies of people who have tried crazy stuff, and it makes all your problems look small by comparison. Or I remember there was a couple times in the last crypto winter where I was just like, oh man, this sucks. Like, these people on my team are fighting. This person's like suing us, you know, this whatever. Like, we lost this much money in some bug and everything sucks. And then, you know, I'd go watch some documentary about like the space program, and like, you know, these astronauts guy like blew up on the launch pad, or like, you know, watch something about World War II or like Band of Brothers or whatever. And I'm like, oh my God, like all the problems we have are tiny. Like, somebody sent me a mean piece of paper by email. Okay, whatever. Like, nobody died. Nobody died today, right? There's actually a great line in that show Succession where Kendall's like on the plane and he's like, we're in a fight for our lives. And his sister's like, no, you're not. You're just sending documents back and forth over email. there's some days you kind of have to laugh about it. And you're just like, I mean, this is, nobody died. Like, let's just get back on the horse, keep building some stuff. You know, who cares? Like, if some angry person's like writing dumb articles or suing you or whatever, like, you know, you can't let that stop you. Keep building good stuff.
Yeah. Awesome. So maybe with that, we'll go to some questions from the audience.
What are your current views on remote versus hybrid versus an office work?
Yeah, I think every CEO is kind of trying to figure out this right now. So there's no one right answer. But for us, what we're doing is, so we went remote first, we call it, during the pandemic, which is not saying you have to be remote. It's saying if you want to go in the office, you can. No one's required to. And we're sticking with that. I like it for now. One thing we are shifting, though, on that is that we want to make the in-office experience great. There was a weird thing that happened where, you know, some of our offices, they weren't really fun to go in because there was kind of, initially they had this much capacity and then only 20% of people going in. So it felt like a ghost town. You know, there wasn't like good food service or games. So we're now in the process of kind of revamping our in-office experience to make it great. We're making kind of a hub in New York and Bay Area. And especially for earlier in career talent, I think it's really more, to them, it's like a perk or almost a necessity, I think, sometimes to be around other people. There's social aspects of that. You know, they don't have maybe as great of a setup at home. And so I think for early in career talent, they're going to want it. And for later in career talent, they're not going to want it. And so we are currently kind of trying to get the best of both worlds and make the in-office experience great, have more and more offsites coming through there so they get access and exposure to more senior talent, but not require people to come in if they don't want to. So far, we're keeping with that. And, you know, we were already kind of, if I was like 15 people all in one city, okay, maybe let's all get together. But Coinbase has offices in a bunch of cities already, and any meeting I was in already had people dialed in remotely, whether they were in an office in London or New York or whatever. So yeah, we'll stick with remote first.
Thanks again for coming and speak to us. You talked a little bit about your own personal way of kind of psyching yourself up during this bear market. Can you share a little bit about what's worked for your team in terms of motivating them through tough times?
Well, I mean, my first thought as you said that was, so I think we really overhired in 2021. We were probably a little irrationally exuberant along with other people. And so over the last year or so, we cut like 50% of the cost out of the business. Cultivating this mindset when you speak with the company, whether that's in, you know, town halls or all hands or blog posts or emails that go out or whatever, and you're kind of cultivating this mindset of agency. It's like, the world is not happening to us. We are leaving our mark on the world, right? And so what is in our control? There's some stuff that's not in our control, like Jerome Powell might change the interest rates and the stock market will go down along with crypto. Okay, that's not really in our control. But what is control? Can we build something that's more innovative? Can we go fix those bugs? Can we like fix this security issue? Can we go get legislation passed? Like, these are definitely things that are in our control. And I also like to think of it, don't be constrained by what's happening in one country, right? This is a global industry. It's a global movement. And so if in one part of the world, like let's say, you know, right now we had, Gary Gensler and Elizabeth Warren on the warpath in the US, but Rishi Sunak in the UK is like super pro crypto. So okay, great, let's go invest in countries that have the door open. And maybe in 4 years, it'll flip and somebody anti-crypto will be in the UK and pro-crypto will be in the US and we'll build in the US then. So there's always something you can do, right? When you're faced with these obstacles, you know, you find like you run into a wall. Okay, well, we can dig a tunnel under it. We can climb over the wall. We can just get some sledgehammers and break through the wall. We can like get in a helicopter, whatever. Like, so it's cultivating that mindset with the team. And I kind of try to be a little bit of that mentality and energy. I do it in all hands. And I talk about, okay, we tried, here's something that we tried. We tried 10 different things and none of them worked. So what did this person do? And I try to look for examples of this in the company and bring them like, okay, I want you to go tell this story in front of the whole company at the town hall, because this is a good example I want others to emulate, right? It's like 10 of the things we tried didn't work. We just went and tried 10 more, you know, like there's not really an option here where we just like give up and feel sorry for ourselves. Like we're never going to do that. We never give up. So I try to find examples of that, elevate those people in the company, speak about it authentically as I can. And everybody should kind of find their own version of that. Like, you know, my version of it might not be authentic for you, but speak whatever feels right to you and talk more about, you know, why you're still going and what you do believe in, what you're skeptical of. If you're scared, if you're upset, like just talk about that too. Being vulnerable is great leadership as well.
Hey Brian, happy base partner here.
Nice. So
thank you for that. I was wondering what your sort of expectations are for the pace of progress over the next couple of years. Obviously, we need some regulatory clarity. We need some killer apps on the consumer side. We need the infrastructure, you know, to improve in a major way again. You know, what are you all thinking about just in terms of timing and pace over the next several years?
Well, I'm always kind of impatient. I always wish things were moving faster. And, you know, Frank Slootman has this great book, Amp It Up. There's a couple books like that where the pace is kind of whatever we set it to be, right? So that's like a leadership question. I think, you know, I try to do this within the company, right? Especially as Coinbase has gotten bigger, we have to fight against, you know, natural tendencies towards bureaucracy and things like that. In startups, this is less of an issue where you are, probably most of you are. But an example is just little things, right? Like if somebody's like, oh, okay, great, I'll come back to you next week with the next version of that. I'm like, how about we meet in 24 hours? Like, right? And you don't want to be a jerk about it, but like sometimes I'll just ask people in front of the team and live in front of the meeting, like, so great, when do you think you can have the next version of that? And it's a little bit of a management technique because, you know, they don't want to say like a really long time in front of all their peers and like, you know, get challenged or whatever. So they set their own ambitious target. I'm like, great, I'm going to hold you to that, right? Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think if you had asked me 10 years ago when Coinbase was first starting, like how long would it take to get, I don't know, like 20% of all e-commerce running on crypto? I was like way optimistic. I was like, well, it's clearly a better system. It's sort of native to the internet and it, you know, chargebacks and it works globally. And I was like, I don't know, probably like 3 to 5 years, we'll have like 20% of all e-commerce running in crypto. I was way off, right? So I don't really trust my judgments on how these things are going to happen. It's usually surprising if something takes off that you didn't expect and this thing takes longer, but that's fine. The goal is just to be trying a lot of things, have a portfolio. You know, I would not have guessed that one thing would take off versus another, but just try to be relentless, set the pace, be the pace car in your organizations and, you know, amp it up. I think we can create whatever outcome we want there.
Thanks. I really like Coinbase's focus as a kind of a mission-focused company and being politically neutral to an extent. Did that have any unexpected negatives, though, after you made the announcement?
So, the negatives of it were that, and we knew this would happen, is that we would get attacked, right? So, immediately after we did that, like, the New York Times kind of started a special team internally to, like, go dig up dirt on us, and they wrote some like fake articles about us calling us essentially racist or whatever. It didn't even make sense. But we knew that would happen, that it would be kind of unpopular. But I do think that, you know, it's actually, it was only unpopular with like a fringe minority, I would say. Most of the reactions I got from it, including from employees of all different backgrounds and everything, was overwhelmingly positive. And they basically said, thank you for finally speaking up. Like, it was getting crazy. You know, we couldn't just come in and do good work because there was this really small group of people that were trying to hijack the company for their own political outcomes or whatever. So we did have 5% of the company leave. We got some negative articles, but we looked at the numbers a year later and, you know, most of our diversity metrics were the same or better. It didn't really, several people had told me when we were thinking about putting that out, they said, you know, no underrepresented person will ever work at this company again. I was like, is that true? I went and talked to our ERGs, our employee resource groups, and they were telling me something very different. They said, you know, we don't really care about that stuff. We just want to come to work and be respected and like do good work and learn on the job. They just wanted the same thing everybody else did. So my instinct was that the fears were overblown. I would say it was a very positive thing, and it's allowed us to not have these unforced errors internally of like employees getting in unnecessary fights and, you know, protesting and like these flame wars happening in Slack channels and internal social media and stuff like that. So it's actually been much better. I would say my job as a CEO is a lot better because I'm not sort of being, you know, these open mic Q&As I think are like an unforced error that a lot of companies do once they get to a certain size. And it only takes one person to sort of, you know, grandstand, hold the mic, kind of distract everyone in the whole company by trying to get you to, you know, on stage, like, how are you going to solve the world's biggest problem of X? And I'm like, I don't know. We're focused on crypto. So we don't do like open mic Q&A anymore. Like, people can submit questions in advance, but you can't like vote brigade, you know, this one kind of current thing issue. Anyway, I would recommend it. I think it was incredibly net positive. And if the worst thing that happens is you get a negative article written about the company, you know, welcome to the club. You're in good company.
Hey, Brian, how do you think about like your proportion of investing in core to new innovation? Like, what kind of process do you have for kind of running this, you know, your team and yourself through what bets to pick and what not to and how to divide the core versus new growth, next billion areas?
Yeah, this is a great question because this would always kind of make me laugh. And when Coinbase was growing and we were like, you know, 500 people or whatever, some days I'd go into one meeting and some employees would ask me like, how can we not be investing in this one thing which is making all the revenue? There's so many side projects distracting us, right? And I'd be like, okay, that's a good point. And we'd go to the next meeting and somebody would say, how can we not be investing in this new thing that is going to be disrupting our business? And it's clearly the future of the whole industry. And we're just caught on the sidelines, stuck in this old mentality, right? And I was like, that's kind of true too. So I was like, how do we reconcile this? And the best idea I came up with for this framework, you know, which we basically borrowed from others, is we call it 70-20-10 resource allocation. And this, by the way, the beauty of this is not that it's some magical formula. The beauty of it is that you have to have some formula to get everybody to sort of calm down and not freak out about this all the time. And so simplified, the framework is 70% of resources goes toward the core. The core is the thing that's making most of the revenue today. So you make sure to keep the main thing the main thing. Don't lose on the main thing. 20% of resources go to these adjacent bets, which are things that are kind of natural extensions of your core. So, you know, if spot trading is going well, let's try derivatives trading. That's like an adjacent bet. And then 10% can be these venture bets, which are high risk, but higher reward. If they work, you can have a higher tolerance for failure. But they're small bets. You're capping the total amount of resources at 10%. So this is what we do inside Coinbase. We measure the 70-20-10. We have definitions of them, actually, and say, hey, we have two or three people we want to go do this thing. And if any of the product group's kind of leaders decide to fund it, it's almost like pitching internal venture capital. You know, if you get any one of the product leaders to fund it out of their budget, then they're like, go. Okay, go try this experiment. But it's within the bounds of that 10% of resources. So, you know, some CEOs, they're very much more like, I have a very clear vision. I have high conviction. We're only doing these three or four things. Like imagine Apple or something. Like they have a very narrow set of products, and they only very, very rarely will do like a new thing. And then companies like Google, historically, they were much more like free for all. They were just like, good ideas can come from anywhere. And like they'd have like four different teams working on chat or whatever. And so we've tried to make sort of the reasonable middle ground of that. And 70-20-10 is what we ended up doing. And yeah, so I know enough to know that I don't know exactly what the next big thing is going to be. So I'm glad we have at least some kind of a portfolio.
All right, I think we're out of time. But Brian, thank you for all you do for the industry and being here today.
Thanks, Seth.